Over two centuries ago, it was England that taxed our tea. Now it's Brussels trying to regulate our companies. Under new European regulations, American businesses face crushing fines, forced disclosures, and foreign red tape that kills jobs here at home. America's laws should be written in America, not Brussels. Reject European regulatory overreach and uphold Trump's trade deal. Paid for by Americans for Limited Government.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again. Thank you so much for joining this live stream. It's another episode of Finding Your Summit podcast, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And as always, I ask you guys, if you would, because we transform this into a podcast, you can go onto my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. It's actually a brand new site that I just put up, so you can go check that out. But under the tab podcast, there is a ratings and review through iTunes. Go in there, please. Jack it up. Give us a good review. It's not about me getting more popular. It's about sharing these amazing stories of these incredible people doing awesome things. Okay. So that's what we want to do. We want to share that with the world. Okay. So on that same note, I want to get into today's guest. I've got two. And the first guy is a guy I had on a couple years ago. And there's a little backstory to that. His name is Yogi Roth. Yogi, how you doing?
I love this story, man. I'm so happy for you on so many levels.
Yeah, well, let me jack this story up, right? So it was about 3 years ago that you had heard about my story, I think, through our mutual friend Jim Mora. So you came over to my place at the time in Hermosa Beach, and you sat down, you're doing a podcast on me. And as you were talking to me, I had the little voice, words were coming out of my mouth, and I had these little thoughts in my mind. And what I was saying to myself is like, I think I can do this. So that was way back when, 3 years ago. And then what you did, you were so generous with your time, because I know you're a busy guy, but you actually sent me this contact with a guy that you were using at the time. And he said, contact this person, so-and-so, he'll take care of everything, get you set up. He did. And you were the first guy I ever had on the podcast. That episode ran June 9th, 2017. I went back and checked it out.
You know what's amazing is that, so our friend Coach Mora, he allowed the Pac-12 Networks and myself to do a documentary series on him and his team, like behind the scenes, all season, all access. So we would be embedded with his team, and we went to training camp, and he'd be mic'd up, and he would do these crazy workouts during camp in between practices. There's always this other guy running with him, and I was like, who is this guy? And it was you. And eventually I would learn your story, because I'd ask Coach Moore, like, who's that guy you're running with? Like, is that his brother? Like, I don't know who it is. And then I'd learn, obviously, what you were chasing and what you were achieving. And I was like, man, I need to sit down and learn from you, let alone interview you to share that with other people. And now to see what your podcast has done, man, every time I get a newsletter, every time I see a new episode come up, I just enjoy it, because you got a gift. And I think if you have a gift, you need to share it. And you've done exactly that. So for what that's worth, congrats.
Well, listen, I appreciate that very much. And of course, Yogi is an analyst on the Pac-12 Network. And at the time, what he was referring to is Yogi would also be going around broadcasting. I think the first time we actually met was at in Corvallis at Oregon State. It was a rainy afternoon. And I don't know if you know this, and Hugh Millen is going to be coming on the show shortly. And certainly with his broadcast that he does with KGR, I'm sure he's been around to every stadium. But I hadn't. And not only had I not been to the updated stadiums, but we also increased the Pac-12, of course, increased from Colorado and University of Utah. And so my goal became, as I was traveling with UCLA for 6 years, my goal became to conquer and run every stadium in the Pac-12. And so that became the goal. Not only did I do it once, I did it twice, you know, because you circle back and play each team a couple of years later. So anyways, it was a great memory. And I owe so much to you for getting me going. And again, and I look back 152 episodes, you know, later, and I go, you know, the guy that helped me from day one, I will help anybody else who wants to get in the podcast business. And I want to be that same role model that Yogi was to me, and that guiding light to really get me off the ground.
That's very cool. Yeah, well. But I love that. Well said.
Yeah. So look, at the one of the things I go back because you also have a podcast, and as we were talking about Life Without Limits, and you've had this incredible story, and you asked me this crazy question. It was like the first question. I'd never been on a podcast before, and it was like, how do you feel about the word limits? And you know, of course, my brain was spinning, you know, around and around. And so I want to put that back to you. You know, again, you're an author. You've done some film projects for ESPN. You've been a coach at USC. You're a current analyst. You've got all these amazing things going on. You're a podcast host. You know so many different people. You speak around the country. And so yeah, I feel kind of silly asking you this, but I still got to tee it up and ask you, how do you feel about the word limits?
Yeah. You know, what's really been interesting, I've done whatever, 100 plus podcasts as well, and no answer has been the same around that. And I think that's beautiful because everybody has their own definition of it. And now on that list of things that you said, I'm also a father and a husband. So now my relationship with the word limits has shifted, as you know, and who knows when you have kids. So to me, I never believed in limits, right? You can't play major college football. Screw you. I'm gonna go play it. You can't coach at SC. Yeah, I can. Watch me. You can't call big games. Watch me. Like that was always a mindset. Now it's like, well, if our five-year-old's like, hey, I want to go bombing down the street on my bike at rush hour, like there's limits around that, dude. Like yeah. That's not allowed. So my relationship with it has changed. I think that you need to have, my dad would say this, limit setting in a permissive society. So we're allowed to do whatever we want in this country. We have to set limits to a degree to teach, right? So think about you and what you do. You can't climb Everest in a day. There's limits to where you can go and how you could go. I can't call the Rose Bowl my first year broadcasting. I'm heading into like year 12. Still haven't called it. It's the only career dream I have. I'll get there. It might be year 24. I don't know. So to me, like my relationship with limits is it doesn't hold a lot of space for me. I recognize that it's there. It's there for a purpose. But the job is to understand what it is, see where it is, and then compete to move past it. And that's become crystallized, you know, in the last couple of years being a dad.
Well, let's add to that. You know, I was going back and reading your background, you were a graduate of Lackawanna Trail Junior Senior High School in Factoryville, Pennsylvania. I can't wait till Hugh Millen, you know, gives his opinion on that. But it sounds like something out of a movie set. Like, how could you make that up? And yet you did. You went on to University of Pittsburgh. You walked on, your roommate's Larry Fitzgerald, you end up playing all the time, and then you go on to USC and coaching. But, you know, for you, what was that like? What were those hard lessons that you had to learn about being that go-getter that you are today?
You know, for me, I always felt as though, and I think every athlete has this, you have a unique trait, right? Hugh's son, Cale, he's a unique trait as a quarterback. You had a unique trait as a wideout. My unique trait that I very rarely shared was my family lineage. So my mom's parents were Holocaust survivors. So when I was 8 years old, I would sit at the dinner table and I would listen to her dad tell me the story again, how he got shot 8 times by a machine gun in his upper left shoulder. And I would listen to her mom talk about how she was walking home from school at 13 years old and was stopped by her teacher. And her teacher said, you can't go home because your family was just murdered. They were all axed to death. They went on the run, right? And their stories are obviously much more there's much more depth to that. But I knew that I had this edge in me that like I can compete like longer than anybody. And I still feel that to this day. And I still feel if you said, Yogi, go in the ring with somebody and, you know, whoever survives is going to live. I feel like I could go harder and longer than anybody on the planet. And that is in my DNA. So for being in a town of 2,500 people with no stoplights, that was pretty much a conservative community growing up in a home that was, you know, my mom's a refugee, I referenced her parents. We didn't have a lot, but I had this thing in my back pocket where I knew when it got hard, like this is when I rose up. And that was almost a place of comfort. The harder it was, the more obstacles that came in front of me, the more joy I would get out of it. And it wasn't healthy at first because it became about proving others wrong. But eventually, as an adult, it's turned to proving myself right. That's a challenge I think every athlete and competitor probably goes through at some form. Most of us deal with that later in life. I try to tell high school kids to deal with that now because it's much more of an enjoyable process. But for me, growing up in that community, I can remember nobody said, go play at Pitt. Even my parents weren't like, go play at Pitt. Everybody was like, sure, can you really play? And it just made the hunger in me like even louder, saying, yeah, man, I can do anything, because triple sessions aren't hard. Double sessions aren't hard. Beating out scholarship players aren't hard. Hard is like running from Nazis. Hard is living on your own as a teenager. And that's still in my head. And that's why I'm not good with people that complain. Like, they get shoved right out of my universe.
Because, yeah, it's noise.
Yeah, what do we have to complain about?
Yeah.
You know, really.
Yeah, well, look, I have to let me bring Hugh Millen into the stream really quick. Hugh Millen is a 10-year NFL QB. He happened to be my brilliant quarterback back in college at the University of Washington. And, of course, we were teammates in high school. So I don't know, Yogi, how many guys you can actually say you played high school football with and went and played at the college level, the same college. And both of us, even though it was different teams, played in the NFL. I got to believe that list is pretty small.
Well, I'll say this. My high school quarterback is a linebacker coach for the Seahawks named John Glenn. So we don't have the connection you guys do, but yeah, we have a fun little one, at least with football, so we can still talk like you guys do.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, you know, the whole world about uncertainty, I want to actually bring this quote up, and it has to do, you know, like with Hugh, he's got two boys, Cale down at the University of Oregon right now, and then Clay, just an absolute stud in high school. And we'll get into the whole state of college football in just a minute. But this whole thing about embrace uncertainty, some of the most beautiful chapters in our lives won't have a title until much later. So, you know, a lot of the things, Yogi, about what you're talking about, calling the Rose Bowl, and it might be in 20 years from now, about the uncertainty of what your life was going to look like when you were growing up. All you knew is to grind and grind because you kind of had that chip. And then with Hugh, I would like to get your feedback on this, Hugh, on about the you know, right now with college football, where that's going to look, and with your younger son who's going through all this recruiting right now. He's also a quarterback in the state of Washington at Mount Si High School. And this guy's got all the goodies. And so, you know, like as a parent, how do you navigate that?
Well, first of all, it's great to be with you guys. I enjoy the inspiration that both of you represent. And so thanks for having me on. But as far as MP, my role with the parent, you know, what the first thing I say, and it's, you know, it's been a theme that these guys have heard is that you control the controllables. And we don't know what's going to happen with this pandemic. And the one thing we can control is our response to it, our attitude about it. And so we're going to have, you know, whether it's a few months like we've had or a few more months, whatever it is, it's our choice. We can be filled with anxiety about that, and we can be miserable about what's happening, or we can focus on, hey, the only thing I control is my attitude about it and what I can do now. I can still make myself better. The kids are finding, you know, basically just about every way they possibly can to keep working to be better. Both the high school son, my younger, and my older son, who's, as you mentioned, at Oregon. So as long as they are still looking, hey, no excuses. You have every opportunity to get better, and you have an opportunity to get better. You'd be better tomorrow than you were today. And so as long as those guys are not making excuses about that, then I'm happy with their approach.
So Yogi, you're going to love this story, because as you both know, my oldest daughter, Claudette, right? And so now if you can go back about 15 years, and Claudette's about 5 years old, and Hugh Millen comes over to my house, and you know, Hugh Millen is, for those who don't know him, you know, what are you, 6'5"? And he's got gigantic, like Michael Jordan type hands, and he's got this big finger, and he gets down, little Claudette, you know, at the time. And so he gets down right in front of her, about an inch away from her nose, and he's got this big long finger, and he sticks it out there. He goes, hey, Claudette, let me ask you this question. He goes, what's the one thing that you can control that you weren't born with, right? So you can control, you can't control your height, your weight, you know, you have blue eyes or dark eyes, your color hair, is it wavy, or, you know, whatever that's going to be. But what's the one thing? And so she's like sucking on her thumb, you know, looking at him, and the wheels are turning like this. It was what both you guys have said and acknowledged is attitude, right? And you can control how you want to approach. And Hugh, you were just talking about it from the standpoint of you can control, you can't control the uncontrollable, but what you can control is the things in front of you.
Yeah, I think the riddle went something like, look, what is the one thing you're not born with? Yogi, follow me on this, all right?
Okay, I'm going to write
it down. This is the riddle. You're not born with it. You acquire it at about age 3 or 4. You can never, nobody can ever take it from you, and you can never lose it until the day you die. What is that thing? And of course, the answer, as Mark alluded, it's your attitude, right? Because I think we kind of get our attitude. I don't know. You can quibble with the number. Maybe it's when you're 5, but it's a relatively young age. You have an attitude, and you know, and you control that. You always control that.
Wow, I love that. I'm curious for you, Hugh, if I can jump in and ask a question.
Please.
How are you controlling your attitude around your kids losing a season or even playing amid the pandemic? Like, how are you dealing with that as a dad?
Well, right now, it's twofold in different ways. My oldest son at Oregon, it's actually somewhat of a blessing for us selfishly that he's home now. And so one of the things I'm doing, you know, I'm out there throwing with him and, you know, coaching him up, and he's coming off of an injury, a shoulder surgery. So we're making sure that his mechanics are where he needs to be. And he's got a couple kids that are college ball players, college receivers that he's able to throw to. So our thing is I always say there's 5 levels of quarterback preparation, okay, in no particular order. A quarterback, you've got again, no particular, you got to be in the weight room, you got to throw, you got to work on your feet, you got to do opponent study, and you got to do playbook study. And some guys are committed. I mean, we have common friends, you know, Coach Mora, he's had guys, he's had quarterbacks, I won't mention names. You can be committed in one area. You can walk into a weight room and say, man, that guy loves ball. Yeah. Well, he loves weightlifting. You know, take a Brady Quinn. You know, and I'm not trying to denigrate Brady Quinn. And maybe he was phenomenal in all 5 facets. But my point is, just because a guy's killing it in the weight room doesn't mean he loves to do film study. I mean, Tom Brady will sit there in that documentary, Tom versus Time. He's, you know, he's got Giselle in the next room, one room over. And he says he'll sit there for 5 hours and not even get up out of his seat doing opponent study. Well, okay, so he's grinding in that area. And so if you're not doing all 5 of those, there's going to be a hole in your game. And so we're trying to do as much as he can, mindful of the 5 aspects of quarterback preparation with him not being in Oregon. And now as for my younger son, he's getting recruited. And there are schools that want him to come down as soon as COVID lifts. Arizona wants him to come down. LSU's been talking to him several dozen times. They want him to come down as soon as the COVID lifts. So that's impacting his recruitment. But, you know, it's all, again, your attitude. It's first world problems, right? You know, you can sit there and bemoan, well, oh, why me? Why did it have to be, you know, in this recruiting cycle during COVID-19? Guess what? You can't control that. It gets back. You can control your attitude and do the best things you can under this environment. And, you know, you can be miserable about it. That's a choice. Or you can just attack, you know, be in attack mode. And so that's when we're at our best. In my opinion, that's who we are, you know, and we're humans. We maybe have a moment of like, God, this sucks. But really, we have to crystallize like, hey, let's control what we can control.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with what you're saying, Hugh. And a lot of times you have to have mentors. And I think it really helps, right? I know, Yogi, you were really influenced, not only some of the guys you play with in college, but also with Pete Carroll, right? Really taught you what the definition of winning and winning in the right way and with enthusiasm was all about. And Hugh, of course, you've been that great leader to your 2 kids as they've navigated their way through. And it's been really awesome because as intense you are and as much passion you have about football just in general, and of course you're the voice, or not the voice, but you're on the local KGR station up there in Seattle and have a show, Dogman. And, you know, yet at the same time, I've been around your kids, I've been around your family, and I don't feel like they get any kind of pressure coming from you. This is something that is like your kid driven. Like they don't secretly really want to be an ice skater or something, right? Mm-hmm. It's really like they can't wait to get out and start throwing and start competing. And so it's a genuine, and I think that's a fine line as a parent, because you know you've been there and you want to push, but you can't push too far and too hard, or as it falls off the cliff.
Yeah, I think that, first of all, I say, what's your goal? You know, if they just tell me one time, hey, I don't want to be an NFL quarterback, then I change. When they say I want to be an NFL quarterback, my first response is get in line, right, Yogi? So you're not going to talk it into existence. You're going to work it into existence. And it's going to go through, hey, how do you prepare and how do you perform? Very simple. It's as simple as that. And that'll declare whether or not you have that opportunity. But the message I try and say is let your work ethic match your goals. If you have lofty goals and you want to, you know, and there's only one out of, two or three out of a hundred, even at the college level, that are going on to the next level, then you better separate yourself. And you got to understand that somebody's dying to outwork you. You know, they're grinding because they want it more than you. And are you matching that or are you exceeding that? Because you gotta have the pain at some point. You can either have the pain of the work that you have to put in now, the grind, or you can have the pain of the regret. Because there'll be a point in your life where you can't come back and redress the mistakes, what you wish you would have done. So choose your pain. You know, and I just say regrets are really unfortunate pain to have to live with.
They sure are. And, you know, I know I'm taking this up into what I'm doing today, not necessarily my athletic past, but, you know, that's why I tell people when things get really hard up in the mountains and it's cold as hell and it's minus 40 and people start complaining or somebody wants to quit, like, it could be 24 hours later, you're sitting in a bar down at ground level, you know, drinking a beer. And like, would you want to regret that decision that you came off because you gave up, you know, right when you needed to be at your best? No, you know, absolutely not. I want to shift just a little bit. And Yogi, I want to talk to you for just a minute from the standpoint of the state of college football today, this pandemic. I mean, it's amazing to think about a few months ago. Like you, I was talking to you about this not too long ago. And we were like, you could have come up with the craziest formula of how the whole Earth, the globe, could blow up all at one time. And I don't think anybody could have ever come up with this scenario exactly the way it's played out and blown out businesses. And so sad and unfortunate for many people have lost, you know, their loved ones. From the standpoint of college football, what are you hearing about the path forward and coming out of this whole thing?
Yeah, because there's a lot there. I'll try to be efficient in my answer.
Yeah.
We just got done with an all-staff meeting at the Pac-12 Network. So that was Larry Scott, the commissioner, Mark Shukin, the president, and some other people. And being in touch with him, I interviewed every head coach last week in the conference, talking to a bunch of people. Everybody is optimistic. Like, there's this narrative out there that the SEC is going to play. They don't care. They're going to put fans in the stands. You're in Texas, they're going to fans in the stands. But in the Pac-12, they're not going to play. And that's the furthest thing from the truth. The truth is that every day the conference commissioners get on the phone along with their liaisons, with their support staff, medical representatives, et cetera. And every day the people leading the conversation around the medical side of COVID-19 and college football are the people on the West Coast. It's the Pac-12 conference. It's Larry Scott and his tribe. And when you look at the schools or the names that he's working with, you're not surprised when it's UW Medical, Stanford Medical, UCLA, USC, Arizona, on and on and on and on and on. So the truth is that everybody's optimistic. The other truth is that nobody really knows. Nobody knows. You don't know if you're in Arizona or if you're in Alabama or if you're in Tennessee or if you're in Washington. You know, all those states have, you know, completely different rules right now in terms of how they're opening up and when they're opening up and what that looks like. Nobody really knows, because the one thing we all are anticipating is that it'll come back, it'll spike. And to me, the biggest challenge will be when that happens. So to net out, college football is doing everything they can to start. A lot of schools are allowing young men to report back June 1st, some June 15th, some July 1st. The goal is to get people back, in my eyes and everything I understand, by July 15th. If you can be back, so that means you had your week or two of quarantine, if you flew from Florida and you play at Washington State, whatever it is, you had your time to get right, get tested, processes are in place, and then we have 6 weeks till the final weekend of August, which is when the first weekend of games would happen. That's the plan. That is the plan. Now, when we get to camp, and you guys know exactly what that's like with all the men in the locker room, and if one person gets it, right now that's what people are trying to figure out. Did the teams have to quarantine for 2 weeks? If two teams play and somebody gets it on Sunday, do both teams have to shut it down for 2 weeks? Is there a buffer to the season? You just play conference games and there's a buffer within that season. So there's a lot at play, but nothing. There is nothing that says football's done. Like, everyone's trying to make it happen. Unfortunately, there's a lot of narratives coming out of ESPN or coming out of the South that are saying, well, everybody's trying to do it except the West Coast. West Coast is leading the conversation, to be really frank.
Yeah, so doesn't this trickle down, though, from top down, from the administrative people? I mean, I saw the other day the University of Notre Dame, and they're talking about a plan to come back here in August, and then they just roll right through till Thanksgiving or something. And I don't know if they're assuming that they can play football or not, but it has to really start with the president, the Board of Regents, all those things. And then from there, it trickles down into the athletics.
Yeah, and the good thing about the Pac-12, and again, it's not getting any play because West Virginia's president or chancellor, he has his comment. Alabama's AD has his comments. Like, the Pac-12's in unison on the West Coast, right? When you hear one voice, it's all the voices. And I think that's really smart versus having schools placate off one another. Well, my state's doing this and my state's doing that. That's not good for anybody, specifically the Pacific 12 Conference in my eyes. So, again, I think that all you can do, and David Shaw said it, Kyle Whittingham said it, you know, two guys that are the veterans on the West Coast or literally the nation, 16th year for Kyle Whittingham coming up. I think he's one of the most tenured, if not the most tenured guy in Power 5 football other than Kirk Ferentz. They're saying it's fluid. And that's just the truth. And anybody that tries to put a period on the sentence with college football and COVID-19 is not accurate. Like, how can you? Like, we don't have a vaccine. We don't have a lot of answers. But I know that they're working their tails off, all these coaches and ADs, to figure out every scenario so they have an answer for when something pops up that maybe they didn't expect.
Yeah. So, Hugh, what are you hearing from – now, you've got kind of – you're on the other side of this. So, Yogi's coming from a network standpoint. You're coming from a parent of a son who's being recruited. So you've got XYZ coach from this school. You had mentioned LSU and Arizona and some other schools that are out there. What are they telling you? Is there something that's consistent with what Yogi said, or is there a different messaging that's coming through?
Oh, yeah, it's entirely consistent with what Yogi said. Absolutely. I think right now my sense is there's not going to be one football coach in America that at any level that's going to make this decision. I don't even think athletic directors are going to make this decision. I think the people that are going to make this decision carry titles like governor of a state, a commissioner of a conference, right? And so I don't, you know, presidents of the universities, I don't even think athletic directors are going to be making the call. So now you could say, is Nick Saban, is he a guy that has, you know, the Alabama governor's number on speed dial? Maybe, but and certainly they're going to be aware of the impact of Alabama football in certain regions. But, you know, so that's one thought. I think the other part is as Yogi mentioned, how do you actually execute this? For example, let's say there's a couple high profile games right now scheduled early in September. Michigan's coming to Washington. Ohio State's coming to Oregon. So let's just say Michigan flies out and the backup long snapper for the Huskies gets COVID on Friday. Now, not to denigrate long snappers, I think you understand the context of what I say. Now, do they quarantine the entire Washington football team? Do they tell Michigan, hey, we can't play tomorrow? Michigan's already flown out. They're in a hotel in Seattle waiting to play the Huskies tomorrow morning. We are going to have to make a decision. My sense is we're going to have to say what tolerance are we willing to accept. And I'll point this out. You say, well, wait a minute, deaths are always paramount. Are we sure about that? I think I can convince you that we actually put a value on deaths. And you know how I can do that? Let's take I-5. I-5 runs through most of the schools in the conference. Certain states is 70 miles an hour, certain states is 65 miles an hour, whatever. But I can promise you that I can cut the traffic fatalities on I-5 if we drop it down to 30 miles an hour. Okay? There's nobody who's going to dispute that. So we drive on 70 miles an hour on I-5 up and down the Pac-12, and there's bean counters somewhere that can say, for every 10 miles an hour we have over, for our convenience, we're going to take X number of fatalities more, right? So we're already on that scale of convenience versus fatalities.
Yeah.
Also in the flu season, we have 60, you know, between 30 and 60,000 flu deaths per year. Well, if we really cared about cutting those deaths down, we could have said our entire lives, none of us grew up wearing masks on an airplane, but it could have been, there's another universe that we could have lived in where all of our lives, we were used to wearing a mask during flu season because we want to say, wait a minute, 40,000 deaths is not tolerable for the flu. We have to try and cut that down under 10,000, right? And social distancing at supermarkets is something we could have been doing for decades to try and cut down on flu. And yet we have 30 to 60,000 flu deaths every year. And we do not want to take the inconvenience. We still want to go to movie theaters. We still want to do, and we could have been doing that all along to avoid flu deaths. So the net conclusion I'm trying to say in all of it is we have already gone through the exercises of balancing convenience and what we want in our lives with the deaths that might arise because of it. And we're going to have to do some of that analysis with COVID and just say, what are we willing to tolerate? And we've already had to make those decisions in the past.
Well, there's no question that college football has become big business, right? And so you're talking about weighing the two and then just the economics of this whole thing and what's the pressure, right? Where it all kind of comes together in one spot. Yogi, what are you hearing about if there is a scenario, right, which you said earlier was correct, which is everything is almost like game day decision, right? Old football analogy. And so if we are going to play in Washington or Michigan flies out to the University of Washington to play the Huskies, you know, are there going to be fans? Are they talking about that kind of scenario or, you know, how does that play out?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, to me, and what Hugh said was really interesting. And the challenge with COVID right now is that there's no answer, right? So if somebody gets sick, like, what can you do? Like, there's no vaccine. They don't know how to treat it necessarily, at least to my understanding, Hugh. Let me know if I'm wrong on that. But with that being said, fans in the stands, packed. I don't know how many fans are going to want to be in the stands, packed. I don't know. I'm sure conferences will make those decisions as we get closer, but I don't see that decision being made until 2 weeks prior to the first game.
Yeah. I mean, we all know that every day is literally something new. You know, the stock market goes up and it goes down and people are freaking out and people are passing away. In one state, the cases are decreasing. In other states, you know, it's just starting to flare up. And so you just don't have a good sense of where this all is. But I do know that I've got two daughters. One of them goes to the University of Arizona. Hugh's got a son at the University of Oregon, and he's in. And this also, you know, trickles down. We're talking about college football right now, but this also trickles down. Hugh's also a quarterback coach for the high school team, of which is his son, who happens to be one of the highest recruited quarterbacks in the nation that's coming out of. And so, you know, what does that look like from a high school standpoint, Hugh? I don't know if you've talked to anybody on your staff or the administrative people, you know, in the state of Washington, but, you know, again, it's a trickle down effect.
Yeah. And our head coach doesn't know anything in terms of what's going to transpire because the people above him don't know, you know, the principal doesn't know, the superintendent of the schools. It's going to be above the pay grade of any football people, I would assume, but What I do hope is, and I do have a little bit of concern, and I hope it's an unfounded concern. And then maybe in a few months I'll gain more wisdom and I'll say, hey, I should not have been concerned about that. But as I sit here right now, I want the decisions to be made on just substantive health issues and a reasonable expectation about the risks involved and what we're willing to tolerate on strictly sensible terms about those topics. What I'm concerned that there may be is some political correctness attached to this, that, for example, well, we want to appear to be sensitive to the issue, so let's push the season out here so that we don't get criticized for being just full throat on football. Look, if football's not going to happen in September, I'm completely willing to accept that. I mean, I feel terrible for the baseball kids, you know, that lost their spring this year. But I want it to be for substantive reasons. I don't want it to be like, well, let's just appear that we're trying to be sensitive to this.
I think it's going to be really interesting regarding exactly what you just said. And when do we say yes? Like, it's such a tricky time. Like, do you say yes? Like, let's go, because it's, let's just take a theory, summertime. Let's get going and get playing, and at least we can get going. And then this thing comes back as it gets colder or whatever may happen. None of us really know. Then we adjust there. Or to your point, like, do we wait and wait and wait and wait and then never play? You know, and your son, that group, that's who my heart breaks for, to be quite honest with you. And I would, an idea that I haven't shared yet, but I'd love to see high school football move to the spring. Like, just give kids a chance to get recruited. Shift. They should already be shifting the recruiting calendar, in my opinion, dramatically. I know some teams don't want that because they got a bunch of commitments, but you know, commitments are up 60%, I think, in high school recruiting right now compared to last year, because kids can't go on visits. They don't want to lose a scholarship. So they're just taking it, but they don't know how the coach coaches. They didn't go there for summer camp. The coach doesn't know how he really works out because he didn't get to see him in the spring recruiting. So that's the part that rips me up a little bit. Like, we don't have a college football season, or it gets truncated. Like, it'll suck. Like, it's my life, right? It's our lives. We love it. But those kids, the kid who was 165 pounds last year, but is now 185 and is like competing for Cali, that sucks. Like, to be, you know, a lack of a beautiful verbiage. Like, that's just, it's brutal for those kids.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an example. There's a Pac-12 school that had offered my son, and they were saying, hey, we want you to, you commit right now, we'll take the commitment. You know, they say, hey, you're number one on our board. You know, I'm not saying they didn't say that, but they said, right now, you commit, we'll take it, we'll set it down. Your kid will be the only quarterback in the class. But you can't go visit there. And, you know, you haven't met in person anybody. You haven't. And then they call and they say, look, we kind of feel like, hey, if you don't want to take this, then we're going to have to offer somebody else. So he wasn't ready to commit. So they turned around, they offered somebody else. That guy committed. And so now that school, you know, is not an option for him anymore. Because he chose, hey, I'm not ready to make that commitment. I haven't even been able to go visit you. So those type of things are happening right now. And with people not, as you said, Yogi, committing without the normal protocol of going to the campuses, meeting the people, seeing the environment. And so it's possible that this could result in more decommitments as the letter of intent day actually approaches. You know, that some of these people that have committed to areas that they've never seen or even shaken the hands of the coach, they might change their thought 6 months from now.
Or they might transfer when the 1 year rule gets enacted. And that to me is even the worst part of guys making an unfounded decision because they're pressured. And it works both ways. Coaches are pressured, programs are pressured, kids are pressured. I would love, and I think this is an opportunity for recruiting and the college football playoff to do the right thing, right? Do the right thing in recruiting and shift your calendar a little bit so everybody knows what they're getting. Don't just guess, because that's what's happening to a large degree. And the CFP, do the right thing. Big Ten might play 10 games. Pac-12 might play 10 games. ACC might play 6 games. We have no clue. Now you're telling me if Clemson or Bama go 7-0 and that's all they play, they're not going to go to the playoff?
Right.
We all know that answer. Right. Do what's right. Make it 5 automatic bids and let the conferences do whatever they need to do this year and shift college football for the better.
I was thinking about the, you know, as you're laying this out, and I've heard before about moving high school football into the spring. And so just kind of playing this out, and both you guys have played college football, so you understand the whole recruiting process. But, you know, I mean, I'm making this up, but if you started in April and that went April, May, June, and then most guys go to camp in August, most college teams go to camp in August. And then where's that recruitment period come in? And those kids that are maybe aren't that first tier or haven't made that commitment that Hugh was talking about because COVID locked us all down and nobody could travel and nobody could go visit. You know, it's just, there's a whole layer of complications that at the end of the day, people are going to have to come together between college and high school and really, you know, lock arms on trying to work out some kind of system that makes it fair to everybody as we're trying to like deal with this whole new, you know, reality that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah. And Mark, to that point, right now there are substantive discussions, to my knowledge, about playing high school football in the spring, certainly up here, I assume in other states. And so now, and Yogi, you know this well, okay, take the timeline. Customarily, for many years, we had letter of intent. Mark, you signed a letter of intent in the first week of February, right? Well, they've added the mid-December, third week of December date. But those dates notwithstanding, okay, if they keep those two dates and you have high school football in the spring, one of the things is a kid has been expected, particularly at the quarterback position, hey, you want to be an early enrollee, give yourself the best chance. So a kid could be put in a situation where he signs his letter of intent. Again, assuming that right now you stayed with the December and February dates, a kid could sign his letter of intent to a school. That school could be pressuring him to come in for spring ball. But now all of a sudden he's, by definition, he's just, he's a Division I player. He's, and at the quarterback position, he's vital and central to the fortunes of the high school team. So the quarterback now is getting pulled by the new school to be an early enrollee and by his high school teammates and coaches to play that season in the spring, as you say, March, starting possibly in March. I would just say, Yogi, the NCAA has to consider the possibilities, desperate times, desperate measures, that maybe you do push back a letter of intent day. Maybe you have one in February, but maybe you have a second one in June, or there's got to be some exceeding to the realities that are happening if in fact these high schools begin to play in the spring.
I agree, and the schools that don't try to sign everybody are going to do well because they're going to be able to clean up. So I look at, like, call it tier two schools on the West Coast, right? Just based on record, say Washington State, UCLA, based on record, like some of these schools that would say, let's just say they don't have to fill up their class by February 6th or 7th or whatever it is, they'll sign half the kids and then they'll clean house with the best high school football players that haven't been offered that are great seniors. Cause that's the, it happened when I was growing up. It was Penn State. It was the demise of Penn State in the late 90s, early 2000s, because Joe Pa would have his whole class committed by the spring, their first junior day. Texas under Mack Brown did it. I mean, history says when you have your whole class done and you don't bring in any seniors that balled out, you're screwed. Right? That's why I love what Oregon did. Like, there's such a nice mix the last couple of years under Coach Cristobal of guys who were ballers as sophomores and juniors, guys that were injured and came out and played well as seniors. So, yeah, it's a mixed bag. And I asked the coaches last week, like, do you think there'll be changes in recruiting? And I think there will. They're talking about it now. It hasn't been ramped up because it's not the first order of business, but it's going to be something that's going to catch a bunch of speed. And I think it should, for all the right reasons for the student athletes.
And Mark, related to Yogi's comments there, it's a little bit off the main course that you're talking about, but in response to Yogi there, when you think of what has happened, just fans understand this, over the last generation, it used to be that far more of the evaluation was occurring evaluating senior year in high school. Okay. And so now, check in 30 years, 35 years, Mark, after we played, far more of that evaluation is getting accelerated earlier and earlier. And so this is the result, in my opinion, Yogi, you see this, you study this for a living, you know this, is that if what we're really, what the, if we're recruiting, let's say we're all recruiters. Okay. Let's just say, Mark, you're Arizona State, Yogi, you're USC, and I'm UCLA. We're going after the same guys, right? What all three of us as recruiters in this scenario are really interested is, tell me how these guys are relative to their peers at, call it, age 20. I use age 20 as a number because Andrew Luck didn't hit the field at Stanford till age 20. And he's considered the best quarterback in college of this century, right? And so you're really interested in that 20-year-old. Now, are you going to have a better idea of how he's relative to his peers if you're trying to evaluate at 16 or at 18, right? You're going to have a heck of a lot. If let's say I have the opportunity to wait till 18 and I can see guys who are early ripe and early rotten, guys that just, if you two are having to make your decisions after freshman or sophomore year, and I get to wait till senior year, All other things being equal, I'm going to smoke you in recruiting because I have more time to evaluate. It would be nonsensical to argue that point. So we've had this dynamic creep into college football where coaches are forced to make these decisions earlier and earlier, and the guys who are late developers are getting pushed off to the side. Because if you're offering a 16-year-old, and let's say you're Alabama, you're only going to offer the best 16-year-old. You're not going to offer an average 16-year-old. You're going to offer the best. Yep. But that's excluding the guy that was a late developer who was at some point going to trump him and excel. We're watching the Jordan documentary. This is the most famous case ever. It's cut from a sophomore team, right? Sometimes there is an early ripe, early rotten dynamic, and the late developers get pushed to the side.
Yeah, well, it all feeds back in your point, Hugh, about the way it's been traditionally, most recently, of recruiting these kids earlier and earlier. It seems like it's become even more competitive than ever. And then we're talking about maybe pushing the high school season into spring, and then this potential pressure of kids were recruited, you know, as a sophomore or a junior, they've committed like your kid did to Oregon, and now they're blown off their senior spring quarter because now that's the way football has shifted because of this COVID, and now they're letting down their team that their whole entire high school team is depending on that star quarterback, you know, to guide them to the state championship.
Yeah. Well, and in KO's case, he was on the basketball team, and Coach Cristobal and Coach Arroyo come into our living room in late December and they say, no, we want KO. Well, they've already taken the team photo. He's practicing with the basketball team. Now, he was not a terribly consequential basketball player. He's a good player, but he wasn't, central to the fortunes of the basketball team. So it wasn't that big of a deal. But if you're talking about now spring football, well, obviously, you know, these recruited guys are central to their team.
So, Yogi, let me ask you this question as we kind of round third base a little bit. From your standpoint, I know the answers, the blunt answer is probably going to be it sucks. But now picture yourself, and we have this hypothetical situation where, you know, all the schools have come back together. They've agreed that we're going to get, you know, we're going to kick off. You guys are covering the Pac-12 networks are going to cover the Husky Michigan game, and you're up there. It fills, I think, 73,000 people, and all you're looking at is bare stands with a bunch of football players down on the field and some referees. I mean, what would that be like?
I hope it's not that. I hope it's creative, right? We've seen it in other countries, whether it's cardboard pictures of fans, I whether it's pumping in music and they change the NCAA rule of crowd noise, like you got to do something. But I think it'll be really interesting because we're going to find out teams that are really disciplined really easily, right? The emotional side of this game that we always feel on the first drive of every half or late in a game, and you guys both know it well, that'll still exist, but it's going to be about execution. So I look at teams that, you know, execute well, right? Whether they have a fullback like Washington's going to have this year, and they're going to be a downhill running team, or they're SC in the air and they're precise, only have 11 plays in the playbook. Like whoever's the most disciplined, and Ted Robinson's my partner, and I steal this all the time from him because he's a tennis guy. Whoever's the most unforced error is going to do great. For us in the booth, we'll do our job. Celebrate the game, coach the viewer. We'll kill it. I'll create hype for myself, and I'll probably tear up doing it because at least I'll see football. Right, I want to see the fans. I want to feel the crowd. I want a third down call. I want to be myself. But if that's not in it, we just have the game, then I'll be okay because we have one of the, you know, most magical things that got taken away. At least that'll be back, and I'll be okay with that.
Yeah, you know, the thing I love about that, Yogi, and I want to go back to the very beginning of the podcast, and we're going to go back to this whole world that we were talking about, attitude and the way you want to look at life and the little riddle that Hugh had come up with and approached my daughter Claudette. And what I want to do is we've kind of talked about, you know, God, what a downer this would be from the standpoint of college football. Maybe we miss a season or get shifted out and it, you know, all these variables that come into it. And the thing that you said that was the most brilliant thing on this pod so far was just like, look, if I get that chance to go call a game and they're blowing the whistle, tears are going to come to my eye because I'm going to bring everything I got to the game. And that's one of the reasons why you are where you are. And you're one of the top announcers that are out there. You're such a joy to listen to when you're there. And that's what we need right now is a bunch of positivity, sprinkling their magic dust on all of us, you know, who have that form to go do so. Hugh, same thing with you. You've got a mic up there in Seattle. You broadcast all over the state. People love to hear you, your analysis of the Huskies and the Seahawks. And so same type of thing. I mean, there it is what it is, but, you know, how can we make and turn a positive or a negative into a positive?
Yeah. Well, so well said, guys. And you know, Russell Wilson up here in Seattle, I think a lot of people know, every Tuesday he goes to this Children's Hospital. And he's been doing that since he first got drafted, and he was doing it in Wisconsin, probably in North Carolina State too. And in my bounce around career, I had an infinitesimal fraction of the career that Russell Wilson had, obviously. But as an NFL player, you're asked to go to these hospitals, you know, just to try and put a smile on a face. So on the occasions I did, and in a few cities, you go to a children's hospital and you see, you know, the effects all these young kids are going through, you know, life-threatening situations, and it just really impacts you. And of all the times that I went in different cities, actually the one that I remember most, there was all these kids suffering from cancer, and, you know, they're going through chemo and their parents are rocked. But the one that got me the most was a 7-year-old kid, not 24 hours before, had run through a glass window screen, a sliding glass door that he didn't know was glass. He ran right through. It was a healthy 7-year-old, and he was laying there paralyzed, and he had a trachea in his throat and all. And his parents were just literally in shock. Like, here I am. I think I was with the Patriots at the time, and I'm shaking the hand of these parents, and they're just looking right through me like zombies. They're just in such a state of shock. Their 7-year-old, 24 hours before, was this healthy kid, and now he's paralyzed and got a tube in his throat, and he's moaning in pain. And, you know, this is 30 years later, and it still affects me. And I keep going, and I say this: unless you're the most privileged person in the world or the most oppressed person in the world, there's 6 billion people in the world, and two people have it unique: the most privileged and the most oppressed. Everybody else has either, they can look and they say, somebody's got it better than me, and I could be really jealous about that. But how about turning to the other side and say, man, I got it better than him, you know, and start to focus on the blessings and all the things that are good, you know. And I'll tell you what, go introduce yourself to a parent group that just had their 7-year-old run through a sliding glass window and is paralyzed and has a tube in his throat. And you'll start to say, hey, you know what, COVID, if we have to play football in front of empty stands, you know, really, let's just adjust our attitude. Then we'll do it. We'll do it. And you know what? People will watch it on TV and they'll enjoy it. And it won't be ideal, but it's better than nothing. And at some point we'll get through this. You know, our attitude's a choice. So you know, however we do it, I know Yogi's going to rock it when he gets his chance, with or without fans.
Yeah. Okay. Both you guys are talking about an attitude of gratitude. I love it. And that's the way, you know, life should be had and lived, in my opinion. I think it's your opinions too. So Hugh, thank you so much for coming on, adding your value, your knowledge to the game. Yogi, you're a star. As I talked about, you know, when we first started the pod today, you're the guy that got me doing this stuff. And it's been one of the biggest blessings of my life to listen to all these amazing stories of people, really ordinary people doing, you know, extraordinary things and their story. And now we're talking about a very sensitive subject. And you know, on the positive side of all this is you know, the fourth quarter of all this conversation is really about emerging out in a really positive way and getting back to what we all love.
Well said, man. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mark. Awesome to be with you guys. Thank you.
All right, guys. Thank you. Yeah. All right, buddies.
Thanks, everybody. See ya.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, NFL.com. So, Until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.